welcome to the Niners Wire podcast. My name is Chris Biederman. I run a site called theninerswire.com. I'm here with two of my contributors, Vince Faussoni and Rob Lauder. And this is our first ever podcast. We're giving this podcast thing a try. We're going to try to come out with a podcast for you every Tuesday during the season. And this edition is going to be previewing the season. So, Rob, Vince, welcome. And how you guys doing tonight?
How are you, Chris?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
So, 2016, 49ers have a new coach, Chip Kelly. They had a quarterback battle that Kelly called a quarterback battle through the majority of the offseason, but it was really Blaine Gabbert's job to lose the entire time just because Colin Kaepernick was hurt. He was coming off three surgeries. Gabbert was working with the first team during the entire offseason program and in training camp. They split reps once Kaepernick was healthy at the beginning of camp, but 2 weeks in, Kaepernick had to be shut down with shoulder soreness. So, the question I have for you guys, given that the expectations for the 49ers are not super high, how many games is Blaine Gabbert going to start before he's replaced? Because what we had last year was an offense that struggled with Colin Kaepernick running it. For a multitude of reasons, including the coaching staff, including the offensive line, including a running game that was lacking with Carlos Hyde hurt. But, you know, the 49ers are looking to rebound this year with an improved offensive line, with an improved coaching staff, and now Blaine Gabbert's a quarterback. Is he going to end up getting replaced? And if so, after how many games is it going to happen?
If I had to guess when it was going to happen, to start out with that, I would probably go with somewhere around, I would probably say after the Bills. I think that's week six, because like I've mentioned multiple times, is that week five little run is just brutal. The one they stand the best chance against is week one against the Rams. And then you have the Panthers, the Seahawks, the
Both
Cowboys.
On the road.
Yeah, Panthers and Seahawks on the road. That's brutal. They have the Cowboys at home, which is still going to be a good game, even without Tony Romo. And he might be back by then, now that I think of it. You have the Cardinals, obviously, and then you have the Bills after that, which seems like a kind of a winnable game. And if Blaine Gabbert even struggles in a game like that, where the team thinks it has a chance to win, then I would think you have some serious clamoring for Colin Kaepernick at that point.
I would agree. I think that Kaepernick got a chance to show early last season how kind of bad it was going to be with the blowouts in against Pittsburgh and Arizona early. So that early stretch is going to be kind of make or break for Gabbert. They will, probably give him a little more time, but that first 3 weeks right there, I'm hoping that it's not going to be a blowout potential like there was last year, but if he looks bad through that, it won't last too much longer after that.
Yeah, I think if they start those six games 1-5, I think they're going to have to seriously consider going with Kaepernick for that week seven game against the Buccaneers, because they'll have the bye week the next week to sort of figure things out, get Kaepernick's footing underneath him within the offense. And then they have the Saints. So coming off that Bills game, which it's a winnable game, but playing in Buffalo, a 10 a.m. start after that stretch, it's not going to be an easy win. Even though the Bills defense is banged up and the 49ers are going to have to run the ball and the offensive line is going to have to play well, but I'm with you guys. I think I'm circling that week seven game against the Buccaneers, give Kaepernick kind of a soft landing spot to come in and play well against Tampa Bay, a team that isn't particularly loaded on the defensive end, the defensive side. So, and then they have the bye week after that. So I think we're in accordance there, and obviously, you know, the big story surrounding the 49ers this preseason is Kaepernick's decision to sit during the national anthem. And for me, covering the team, it's been kind of a whirlwind. It was a story that broke, right as I got home after that third preseason game about midnight, and found myself writing about Kaepernick's decision not to stand during the national anthem until about 2 or 3 in the morning, and it's been one of the biggest stories in the country since, and we had the president weigh in this week. We had U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe decide that she's going to take a knee during the anthem. We had Eric Reed join Colin Kaepernick in taking a knee for the anthem. Nate Boyer, a former Green Beret, has supported Kaepernick and has talked a lot about Kaepernick's stance. And you know, being there and seeing it all unfold, to me, it's almost it's a difficult topic, because there's the message that Kaepernick is trying to get across to people, and I think there's the message that people are taking from Kaepernick, and I think there's a gray area that leads to a lot of misunderstanding in the way the message is being portrayed, whether it be the media or, you know, social media or whatever. But I think it's interesting. I'm curious to hear what you guys have to say about it.
It's just, I've never quite seen something that's that polarizing. I mean, you're either, you know, on one side of the fence or completely on the other side. You know, there's not a lot of discourse in the middle. I think that you're either, you know, acknowledging that it's his right, or completely the flag is like the symbol of, you know, everything to you. So I think that a lot of it comes from also people just kind of disliking Kaepernick, it seems like. I mean, when Eric Reid did it, there wasn't much of a backlash. Obviously, he wasn't the first person to do it. But I think that if it would have been another player, maybe it wouldn't have been as big of a deal. Or not as big of a deal, but as there wouldn't have been as much backlash. So that being said, I mean, it is, you know, his right to do so, but I think that him calling Kaepernick the player had a lot to do with it in my eyes.
That's an interesting point. With me, I went through kind of like what you were talking about, Vince, is like my initial reaction was kind of a little taken back. I was like, wait a minute. Like, I always understood the message he was trying to put out, but to me, it almost seemed like he was opening up a new can of worms, so to speak, with the way he was going about it. So it took me a while to kind of, like, I guess you could say, gain my bearings on the whole thing. And, you know, having been a veteran, my first reaction was, wait, 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 that's the flag. That's the anthem. That if there's, in my opinion, if there's one thing you don't touch, it was always that. But like I said, as time went on and I thought about it, I was like, well, it's 100% his right to do that. That's, you know, those are the values that I signed up to protect. And once I actually listened to what he was saying and kind of allowed myself to take in what he was trying to accomplish, it made a lot more sense. And to me, my only, it's not even an objection, I guess you could say the only advice I would offer to him at this point is to kind of start clarifying exactly where he hopes things go, and like kind of giving his message a little bit more of a, it's hard to say, like a little bit more defined, and start letting people know what they think should be accomplished before, hopefully, one would think he would start standing for the national anthem again after he sees change. But for him to do that, I would like to know what his change is and what exactly he's hoping he gets accomplished.
And that's going to be the big question going forward is how much time is he going to be able to spend on his message and clarifying his message and working with these different social groups to make his message more clear and to make it more apparent and available for anyone who might be on the fence, because he's a quarterback in the NFL, and he's, you know, like we just talked about, he might be the starter at some point, and he's going to have to be ready. And I think Sunday was interesting. He was supposed to speak at a church in San Francisco, and he didn't show up. And, you know, there was a scheduling conflict or whatever, but it kind of points to what Rob is saying in that, you know, he needs to clarify his message, and he did, you know, in speaking in these media scrums, it's a little bit difficult to be completely clear with what you want to say, because you're standing there, you're surrounded by 30 reporters, and you're only given, you know, 15 minutes before the PR staff is shooing you away. But, you know, how much time is Colin Kaepernick gonna have to devote to his cause? How you know, is he gonna be traveling on off days to go, you know, talk to Nate Boyer more and meet with veterans and talk with, you know, local minority leaders and things like that? I mean, being in the NFL is obviously a full-time job. Being a quarterback is, you know, when Colin was a starter, he was in the facility at 6 a.m. and would be one of the last guys to leave at 8 or 9 at night. So, you know, if taking on this social stance and with everything that he's talking about doing, he's not going to have time to do both. He just can't. So his message is either going to be continued to, it's going to be, misunderstood by people because he can't provide that clarification that I think some people are looking for. And so it's going to be interesting to see how his case evolves, how his stance changes, who he reaches out to, who he connects with. I think Nate Boyer was a good step, particularly, you know, from the standpoint of someone within the military, because a lot of people criticized Kaepernick initially just because of they thought it was an anti-military stance he was taking, when really it was about other things. So I think taking a knee was a good step in that direction, and it sounded like that was Nate Boyer's idea, or at least he inspired the idea. But yeah, from a football standpoint, it's really interesting because he's a guy that's fighting for a job. If he doesn't win the starting job, and if he doesn't play well if and when he takes that starting job, he's probably not going to be a 49er next year unless he renegotiates his contract. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff that is involved in that, including the future of the general manager, Trent Baalke, who may or may not be there next year. And another interesting aspect that hasn't really been talked about that much since it happened, but after that preseason finale, Kaepernick spoke glowingly about the organization and said it's a phenomenal organization, and he really appreciates the fact that the 49ers have stood by him through all this, and the 49ers have. The organization has given him the platform. They released statements supporting his right not to stand for the national anthem. And you wonder, you know, there was a lot of talk about other league executives wanting nothing to do with Kaepernick if he were to hit the open market because of this stance and everything that comes with it. And maybe Kaepernick's ultimate home for the long term is with the 49ers, whether he's a starter or not. And maybe he's realizing that now, given the way his message is being received throughout the NFL, and he might have to renegotiate his contract. So, you know, the 49ers aren't on the hook for $14.5 million in April if he's injured, because they don't want to play him at risking the fact that he could get hurt again like he was last spring and guaranteeing his full salary. So he might want to renegotiate that thing. But enough of me rambling about Colin Kaepernick. So easy segue here. So the 49ers have a young roster, a new coaching staff. They've drafted a lot of players that they've been intent on sticking with through these past few years and haven't dipped into the free agent pool. So they have some young guys that are kind of intriguing and that are really, it's up to these young players to take these next steps in their evolution to become good players and contributors on a winning team. And I think that there are a few guys, but who are you guys going to highlight when you look at 2016 in terms of pivotal guys that will end up, you know, making or breaking this 49ers season?
Well, I'd have to start off with, I guess it's the most obvious choice, is their first round picks over the last 2 years. It's just, I was always so enamored with the idea of taking DeForest Buckner after they'd already gotten Arik Armstead because of the chemistry they had. They're both almost the exact same size. And to me, it was almost this intimidation factor. I mean, you have to think, you're an offensive lineman breaking the huddle, walking over to, you know, you see two defensive linemen just standing at the ball that are both 6'8 and 300 pounds, just waiting for you to come to them. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this, you know, they're just beasts, and it's amazing kind of to think about what they could develop into from the level of success that they're already going to see. And just kind of to your point, it seems like Arik Armstead from last year to this year, whatever he did in the off season was, you know, needs to be clarified, because it sounds like he came into training camp a completely different player that was really kind of handling the offensive line at will. And this is an offensive line that seems to be miles and miles ahead of last year. So I think the fact that Arik Armstead seems to have taken this really, really solid step forward, and now DeForest Buckner pretty much gets to follow him in whatever footsteps he takes, and they'll kind of, I think the two of them are almost going to, their success is going to be tandem with one another, kind of for the foreseeable future, for however long lasts. So, and as always, you always want to build from the football out and not in the reverse. So I think they both represent this really, really smart and solid step in kind of ensuring the team succeeds in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the development of all our young players is going to be fun to watch pretty much across the board. Personally, I was telling these guys, really, I'm really excited about Jaquasi Tartt. I just think that the athleticism there has a lot of potential, especially with all the kind of different packages we're going to be in. I think, you know, it's been said time and again, we're probably going to be a lot out of our base defense this year. So having a guy like that, it's exciting because I just am excited by the kind of that transitionary position. Aside from that, I wrote an article earlier about on Trent Brown, and you know, he's got Von Miller saying now that he's you know, one of the tackles that's stumping him and stuff like that. So just having kind of that force on the other side of the line, especially when he wasn't, you know, that guy last year. I mean, they had Pierce starting over him, and you know, that is kind of telling of itself. So just to see a guy emerge like that, I'm hoping that a lot of those pop up all over the place, and it'll be something to look forward to.
Yeah, for me, I think the offense, the success of the offense is going to come down to Carlos Hyde and his health. Because I think, like you mentioned, Vince, it, the offensive line is should be a lot better, and Trent Brown's going to be a big part of that. But if Carlos Hyde can have a breakout season and be the type of back that is a candidate to lead the NFL in rushing yards like LeSean McCoy did in Chip Kelly's first season with the Eagles, that's going to be the only way, the only chance the 49ers have it at being a competitive team and not being in the cellar in the NFC West. They're going to need a 1,500-yard season from Carlos Hyde behind that offensive line. And so it's going to come down to his health. It's, you know, he missed 9 games last year with that stress fracture in his foot. He had a pin inserted into that foot. So that's always kind of a tricky proposition. Especially for a running back, and he's not a guy that has ever shied away from contact. He's always been the guy that wants to make the defenders, wants to punish defenders for trying to tackle him. And credit to him, he was second in the NFL last year behind Marshawn Lynch in yards after contact, but it came at a price, and he missed the last 9 games of the season with that foot injury, and he's coming into the regular season in the NFL concussion protocol after suffering a head injury against the Packers. So Carlos Hyde, to me, is really the indicator of this team, and whether or not he turns into that player, that Pro Bowl caliber player, that fantasy darling, you know, he's going to be the difference between the 49ers being, you know, one of those middling competitive teams that's not going to be easy to play versus sort of what they were last year when they just weren't any good because they didn't have any talent on the offensive side of the ball. So to me, that's Carlos Hyde is going to be the most important player in 2016. I know everyone likes to talk about the quarterbacks, and rightfully so, but to me, if Blaine Gabbert just doesn't turn the ball over and the 49ers are able to run the ball and Chip Kelly's able to keep defenses off balance and trying to catch their breath, I think the 49ers are going to be a tougher team to play than a lot of people anticipate. So, yeah, I think, you know, what do you guys like about the 49ers offense? There's not much, but what are you looking for in 2016?
You know, if they can get that offensive line conditioned and ready to go, that's just the biggest point for me. I mean, that along with the running backs, I mean, the receivers obviously from what they were last year with losing Anquan and now Bruce Ellington. But, you know, if they can get that offensive line just and the tempo up to snuff, then, you know, they're going to be staying on the field longer just in general. I mean, obviously, but that's really what it all comes down to for me.
And in terms of the running game, what I thought was impressive throughout the preseason, and it didn't really matter which running back was on the field, they were all seeing really, really consistent success. I mean, every single one of them from, you know, Carlos Hyde to Kelvin Taylor, I'm glad he made the practice squad, by the way, they averaged like 5 to 6 yards per carry, you know, and it was a really, really consistent success. And, you know, through vanilla offense that was, you know, likely not, you know, a very, very small glimpse of what Chip Kelly has to offer. So I think if you couple that with, I'm really looking forward to seeing how Chip Kelly uses the tight ends. Obviously, he's really, really renowned for utilizing tight ends and throwing to them more often than receivers for the most part. And I think with Vance McDonald finally catching on to the fact that you should catch the ball and hold on to it and keep it with you rather than, you know, allowing the other team to have it or the ground to have it, I think that I think he's going to turn into probably one of, you know, a top tier tight end in the NFL. Not, and it sounds bold, but I think the way that he's always had absolutely everything but the hands. And if he's improved those to where they're capable, then I think Chip's going to love taking advantage of him. And I'm a big Blake Bell fan. I think he's, you know, 6'6", 250, and he's still learning the position. I see a lot from him, even though we didn't see much from him for the preseason. So I think running backs and tight end are where Chip Kelly's offense is going to live this year.
Man, Trent Baalke would be so happy if Vance McDonald had a good year. Like, Vance McDonald having a good year might be the reason, and Tank Carradine. If Tank Carradine and Vance McDonald have good seasons, that might ultimately be what saves Trent Baalke's job going into next year. And I think if you're Trent, that is a horrifying proposition because of just, you mentioned it, of Vance McDonald's inconsistent hands. And I will say, I'll give Vance credit. During training camp and in the preseason, he looked night and day a different player this year for whatever reason. And I think a lot of it has to do with Vernon Davis being gone. He mentioned having a kid. He had a son in the offseason, I believe. And it sounded like that changed his perspective a lot, and he's able to take some pressure off of himself now because of that. So, yeah, Vance McDonald is another guy. I mean, the 49ers don't have really talented receivers, or at least any experienced receivers of note outside of Torrey Smith, so it's going to be up to Vance McDonald to take that step and to be a reliable target and to be a mismatch problem, because really he's the only mismatch problem the 49ers have on offense. And, you know, he's faster than most linebackers, and he's obviously bigger than safeties. So he's going to be a guy that the 49ers need if they're going to be productive in the passing game at all. And I think Trent Baalke understands that. And you look at that 2013 draft, I think Eric Reed is a good player, but he hasn't been locked up beyond his fifth-year extension yet. Tank Carradine, who I guess he signed his one-year extension today, and I think that's something we should probably hit on too. He's a guy that Trent Baalke is going to be counting on because he was a second round pick. And, you know, if you don't hit on second round picks, it's a great way to get fired if you're a GM. So it's getting to that tipping point for Trent that he needs these guys to develop. They're getting towards the end of their contracts, and he needs them to provide a foundation for the future. Otherwise, the 49ers are going to be in a position where they're rebuilding with likely a new GM next year.
Yeah, it's a weird job. I mean, if it's really simplistic to say, but it's a weird job that's so reliant on other people. And at times I feel bad for him, and at times I don't. I mean, the times when I don't feel bad for Trent Baalke is when you list out all the, you know, the ACL picks he's made, and how much they haven't panned out. And then you take the time to think of, well, if he would have taken healthy players that were around the same level, what kind of an investment would we have seen from those? And so it's, at times like that, I don't feel bad for him. But at the same time, there's these drafts that initially, when you look at how they were initially graded or what have you, that just shows how reliable those are. They seem like really, really good drafts and really solid picks. And then you have these, you know, events like Alden Smith's and Colin Kaepernick's where his best picks are even, you know, finding ways to be considered bad picks. So it's such an interesting job in which, you know, what other job in the world can you have success like 35% of the time and be considered really, really well at it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting with Carradine and McDonald because when you're drafting guys like that, I think, you know, second rounders, when your team's, you know, going to the NFC Championship game, you don't really expect to have them be the major contributors of your team in less than a couple of years. So I don't know if he was kind of looking long-term with those guys, but they do, Vance at least, looks like he's coming into his own. And, I mean, Carradine looks better at, outside linebacker. So maybe that's where he belonged all along. But, I can't really knock him too much for drafting kind of project guys at that point. But now that, the time arrived quicker than expected for them to step up, I'm glad to see that they're kind of coming along at least.
It's interesting to me because just in the broad scope of the way people talk about general managers in the NFL, you know, fans only look at their own GM's shortcomings and what happens in the draft and everything like that. But if you take a macro look, like if you were to look at every other team's draft and all their performances in terms of hitting on draft picks and stuff over the last few years, like Trent Baalke has a lot of guys playing football on his team that he drafted. You know, for whatever that's worth, I mean, there are a lot of teams that even Bill Belichick is not a good drafter. He'll have guys that he'll draft in the second, third round that just haven't turned into anything productive. And Trent Baalke, I guess, you know, whether it's because he cultivated the situation, he's had guys stick around. You know, Eric Reed going back to 2013. The 2012 draft is, there's no one left on the roster from the 2012 draft. And no one, let's see, who was the best player in the 2012 draft?
I think the only person left in the NFL from the 2012 draft is like Joe Looney.
And Joe Looney, is he still with Tennessee?
I don't even know if even that holds up.
Yeah. So, I mean, 2013, if McDonald turns into a productive starter, that'll be huge for Trent. If Carradine turns into, you know, I think Carradine has a great chance at leading the 49ers in sacks this year. Eric Reed is a dependable starter. So those are your first three picks from 2013. That's not bad. Usually in a draft, you want to yield maybe a starter or two and then a back end of the roster contributor type guy. So he did that in 2013. 2014, he started with Jamie Ward and Carlos Hyde. Marcus Martin has not been good. Chris Borland is obviously retired. Brandon Thomas, Team ECL, is on the Lions practice squad now. Bruce Ellington is an interesting case. He's always been hurt. He's obviously done for the year this year. Dante Johnson, probably a good fourth round pick. Aaron Lynch, probably a good fifth round pick, except this year it's really hard to feel good about what you saw from Aaron in the offseason and the fact that he's probably 20 pounds overweight. He knew he was going to be suspended, which isn't great for him. Keith Reeser is probably going to have another fifth-round pick from that draft, is going to have a pretty significant role. So you look at the 2014 draft. I mean, if Chris Borland would have stuck around, it really would have been a slam-dunk draft from the standpoint of the number of players you want to get that turn into contributors. So, I mean, we could do this, you know, 2015, all those guys are still around except Smelter and Silberman. Trent Brown could end up being the best pick Trent Baalke's ever made. You guys talked about what Von Miller said about him. Joe Staley says he thinks he could be one of the best tackles ever. He could be an all-time great just given his physical skill set. And this was a guy Baalke drafted in the seventh round after a career at Florida where he wasn't particularly productive and he was overweight. And now he looks like he could turn into one of the best right tackles in the NFL. So
it's just really cool. If didn't mean to cut you off there. It's just, you know, when you hear like lofty praise from a guy like Staley and he's a teammate, maybe you kind of shut it off a little bit. But when you start putting it all together and what Von Miller said about him being literally one of the hardest tackles he's ever faced, and then you couple that with what Staley said and the fact that Anthony Davis pretty much volunteered to move to guard because I think he realized he was not going to beat out Trent Brown, which is, you know, Anthony Davis is a mid-first round pick. So it's pretty impressive when you combine all those things together and maybe it's not just fluff.
Yeah, it's true. And I was just thinking, you know, even going back to his draft strategy, I think that I can't fully knock it. I mean, all of the players on our D-line pretty much, I mean, I guess with the exception of maybe like Purcell, were drafted by him, essentially, as far as I'm aware. And then O-line, kind of similar story, except for Beatles. So, I mean, it's just, you know, building through the lines, I'm behind that strategy. It's just that right now, you know, we're not ready to chase anyone in free agency yet or anything. But I don't know, having that as a base for the team is just, I don't know. That's a good plus for Baalke, in my opinion.
Yeah, and what really kills him though is the fact that he hasn't drafted a quarterback since Colin Kaepernick, and he hasn't drafted a receiver earlier in the fourth round since AJ Jenkins. And so, you know, I think Trent has made it clear he knows where he butters his bread, and he knows what kind of football team he wants to build, and that's a team that is physical and that's big. And it wins from the inside out. And I think that's kind of who the 49ers were when Trent took the job, you know, with Jim Harbaugh running the team. But that team had some good receivers and it had a tight end who could stretch the field and did a lot of things that a good receiver would do. But so, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. It's the year of the quarterbacks and it's the year of Trent Baalke. because the quarterbacks are a direct referendum of him as a general manager, because these are the quarterbacks that he's picked. These are the guys that he's given Chip Kelly to work with. And if it were up to Trent, Colin Kaepernick probably wouldn't be here. But I think Chip wanted Kaepernick to stick around. So with everything else we talked about regarding Kaepernick, how is it going to shake down? And how is it going to relate to Trent Baalke's job? Because it would seem that Chip Kelly is going to be safe no matter what happens this year. And I think with that, I'd like to thank you guys for having this, starting this podcast with us. Thank everyone else out there for listening. We're going to, like I said, try to do this podcast every week. It's going to come out on Tuesday mornings. And yeah, hope everyone enjoys the start of the season. And thanks for listening.